Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
I picked the wine today, Hannah.
Yes, you did.
And it's not a movie tie-in. It's a this time of year tie-in. And it's not a Cinco de Mayo tie-in.
It is a Kentucky Derby tie-in.
It's from Washington State. It's by 14 Hands. 14 Hands celebrates the spirit of the wild horses that once roamed the Columbia River Basin. And after tasting this wine, I think there might be some horse in it.
Shouldn't it be from Louisville?
I don't want Kentucky wine.
Mm. I don't know, though. Maybe Kentucky wine would be better. And it's actually fine.
We have seven.
I know.
Films this week. I saw six. How many did you see?
I saw six as well.
As you said, there's one that everyone's going to see, and six that no one is going to see.
Exactly.
Do you really believe that?
Just us.
All right. Well, we're going to start with the big Marvel blockbuster, and then there's six, I don't know, independent, lesser, foreign documentaries.
It's a veritable smorgasbord of film.
it's so Swedish chef of you.
It's a smorgasbord.
All right, well, let's kick it off with what I think is the best film of the week, Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 2 by Mr. James Gunn, who has now made my two favorite Marvel films. I like both Guardians of the Galaxy more than any Avenger film and any solo film. They're light, they're breezy, they're a breath of fresh air, they're funny, the soundtrack is rocking. Is there any better Marvel film than Guardians of the Galaxy, Hannah?
No, but what's the other one that he's done that you really like?
The first one.
Oh, so that's just those two.
Yeah.
It's Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1 and Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. I'm not sure I would call it the best of the Avenger films because I like them all, but I enjoy this one a lot. I mean, it's hands down the biggest movie of the week. It should be the one that folks go and see. But if they didn't see Guardians of the Galaxy to begin with,
everybody did.
I don't know, but for those who had no interest in seeing it, they're not going to have any interest in this
one
either.
Well, it'd be like Avengers Age of Ultron. Well, if you didn't see Avengers 1.
It's true.
Well, everybody still went to see Avengers Age of Ultron.
Well, I think it's the same people that just keep going to see these things, but it is fun, and I love that it's one of those ones that just embraces the corniness of it, and the soundtrack is like awesome 70s music. I downloaded the first volume back, what was it, in 2014? And I will likely download the second volume because it's Sam Cooke, it's Fleetwood Mac, it's great stuff.
I didn't know there was a name for this type of, it's not a gimmick, but what they're doing with the soundtrack. So you're watching these fight scenes, really is what they are, and then in the background is all the fighting, and in the foreground is the character, cold as ice, smooth as the other side of the pillow, whatever you want to call it. And usually walking in slow motion and smiling. Or if it's the opening of the film, it's Baby Groot dancing. And instead of choreographing, setting the scene to a score, they're setting it to a 1970s era rock tune. And Anne Hornaday of Washington Post says that's called needle drop movies. They just drop the needle on a good song, and there you go. Apparently Martin Scorsese is very good at this back in Goodfellas. It can be done awful if you remember Suicide Squad.
Oh, yes.
They did that way. But Guardians of the Galaxy does it right. There will be a Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 in a few years. I hope James Gunn does it again. Give me more of this.
Yeah, and Rolling Stone had a really good article, too, basically talks you through the various songs and why they were picked and what they represent. So that was fascinating to see, too. And one of the things I wasn't really aware of at the time, and looking back at it, I go, oh, that's interesting, is that the soundtrack, the music, is really supposed to really represent the main character's long-lost mother, his dead mother. So it was the music that that she really loved, and that's why it's so near and dear to his heart.
My favorite, they do it like five or six times throughout the film. My favorite one, where I think it really all comes together, is Michael Rooker, who plays Yondu, the blue guy. He's taking revenge on mutineers on his crew that took over his ship and threw him in jail. And he is cleaning house in a slow motion, and dead bodies are raining from the sky. And it's all to this light poppy, "Come a little bit closer, you're my kind of man." And it's so, that song is so inappropriate for the scene, but it's so inappropriate, it is appropriate.
Throughout the entire movie, that's how it plays, and it's just awesome to listen to, and it's fun. This movie does everything that a sequel is supposed to do. It builds on the backstory that you saw in the original. It introduces some new characters. It expands the ever-expanding Marvel universe that just seems to somehow keep growing. It has these quirky characters. It's got heart. It's got humor. It's got action. The only issue I may have had with it, somewhere in the middle, I was getting a little bored with the fact that two sets of the main characters are separated for a big chunk of this film. And so you're kind of waiting for them all to get back together, this ragtag band of Guardians of the Galaxy. And so while you're waiting to figure out exactly where the story is going, it took a little bit of a turn for me. I wanted them to get back to one united group a little faster.
Well, if I had to pick something I didn't particularly care for, it's... So every character has their own particular problem. It also happened in the last film. It has to, you know, happens in every superhero story. You've got Star-Lord finding his father. You've got Gamora in two arcs, her unrequited, or, you know, unacknowledged romance with Star-Lord, and the fighting that she has with her sister, Nebula. You've got Drax, you got Baby Groot just hanging out, but the one I didn't care for was Rocket. Rocket the Raccoon.
No, he's, I love Rocket.
He's great, but his story arc was his defense mechanism. He's so snide, he's so sarcastic, he's so off-putting that people are saying, you know what, if you keep doing this, you're not going to have any friends. And it's like, okay, I'll stop doing it. And that's, okay, he's got the lamest story arc. Maybe it's right up there with Drax.
It's a little of a stretch, but they have other reasons for existing. And so with Rocket, voiced by Bradley Cooper, is just a lot of fun. He's just, you know, he's there to provide a lot of the...
He's the slapstick.
He's the slapstick guy. Drax, I loved in this movie. I thought he
All he does is call the new character Mantis, played by Palm Clementieff. He just calls her, "You're ugly, and you're revolting, and you're sexually disgusting."
But he delivers all these lines with this deadpan look that just makes you chuckle every time. And he's so inappropriate. And it's just, it's funny. And I mean, he's this big, hulking, ugly guy who is essentially telling this this poor alien chick that she's ugly because she has these antennae coming out of her head, but that's because she's an empathic. And so that's what her antennas pick up, other people's feelings. But it's just the relationship. Yeah, you mentioned the relationship between the sisters. That's sort of a Wicked kind of relationship thing going on there, where it's a little like Elphaba versus the Good Witch. And, you know, you kind of know where that's going to eventually go. But the characters are, for the most part, well drawn. I mean, I just, your main character, Peter, played by Chris Pratt, Chris Pratt is just perfect for this role. He really is. He's just the right mix of heart and hero and reluctant hero.
He's the same character as he was on Parks and Rec.
He's the same character he's in everything. Jurassic World. Isn't he Jurassic World?
He's Jurassic World.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the same vibe, but he fits it well. And you just can't help but like him and feel sympathy for his character. He's trying to figure out who his alien father is, and that's really what this story is about. It's about family. This whole movie is about family. It's about trying to find your real family versus embracing your friends as family. And so it's got heart.
Marvel films usually have a cameo or four, some better than others, some more surprising than others. And there's one in here I'm not going to tell you about, which is hysterical, and I just laughed. But there's one I thought was lame, and I didn't like it, and he shows up twice, and it just does nothing for me. Sylvester Stallone
yeah,
is in this movie. I don't know why. He's does a poor job. He doesn't fit. He draws us out of the movie. Why is Sylvester Stallone in this movie?
Yeah, his character is probably the weakest link. It was a little odd. I think they were just introducing him probably for maybe Volume 3. I don't know. They set up his character to be potentially a bigger character later on. I'm reluctant to give away some of the really funny moments. I don't think it's a surprise for anyone that Kurt Russell's in this movie.
He's on the poster.
And one of the fascinating things they do, though, is they have this scene at the beginning where it's Kurt Russell's like a 30-year-old.
Just like they did to Robert Downey Jr. in Civil War.
Yeah.
They de-aged him.
And it's quite impressive.
Looks like you really feel
like you are watching the 1970s Kurt Russell, and then they, you know, fast forward 30 some odd years and you see him as he is today. So I enjoyed that character. I enjoyed his arc. It's just a good fun flick.
It's very fun. It's awesome. I had a great time with this movie. Unlike our next one, it's called The Dinner, and it's pretty much the polar opposite of Guardians of the Galaxy. You don't feel good at all. It's not light. It's heavy. It's confusing, it's nebulous, there's a lot going on here that I'm not sure even the director meant to happen. The Dinner is based on this best-selling novel from 2009, think like Gone Girl, but, you know, in Holland. This novel swept Europe, selling over 1 million copies. And this is the third film made from it. The Dutch made a film, the Italians made a film, now it's the Americans' turn. And who did they hire to play the main character, Paul, but a Brit, Steve Coogan, with the most suspicious American accent I've ever heard in my life. Two couples, one very posh restaurant, and they're about to torture the waitstaff because they're coming to air it out. Their kids did something bad. I mean, terrible. Some can't admit it to themselves. Some are trying to hide it. Some want to do the right thing. Hannah, did they figure it out?
I don't know. It ended so abruptly that I wasn't quite sure what happened at the end there. They figure out some things. I was okay with Steve Coogan's accent. I like Steve Coogan. I thought the acting was actually very good throughout this movie. You had Richard Gere playing this congressman who's running for governor, and Laura Linney's in it. And it's just a very strong cast in a very bad movie. It picked up after an hour and a half. So the last half hour of this film started to go somewhere for me, and I sort of engaged a little more than I had. And then it ended in this weird way where I was just like, okay, I was ready to give it the benefit of the doubt, but I found the ending to be very disappointing. And ironically, with Richard Gere as this politician, it's the politician who has the conscience of the bunch. I think he did throughout. I felt that projecting where his character arc was going.
So it's a morality play.
It is.
Where does the instinct to protect your child stop and the moral imperative begin to do the right thing? For some people, it's very, very, very far over. Like, they will protect and protect and protect no matter what the child does. And that's pretty much Laura Linney. And a little bit Rebecca Hall, who's the fourth of this quartet. This is by, The Dinner's by a man named Oren Moverman. He directed The Messenger back in 2009. I really liked that movie. That was Woody Harrelson. And he wrote Love and Mercy, the Brian Wilson biopic from a couple years ago that got a lot of notoriety. So this guy knows what he's doing. But why direct a story for the third time? I mean, that's a conscious choice, I guess, you know, to introduce it to Americans, but it's shabby. It's not, it should be taut. It should be tight. But they go to flashback and they go to Gettysburg.
Yeah,
what is going on with Gettysburg? Why am I in Gettysburg?
Yeah, the chronology was very wonky to follow because essentially you're at this dinner at this very pretentious restaurant, and the benchmarks throughout this movie are the various courses being served. It's like a 5-course dinner where the waiter comes and explains every ingredient on the dish. And they're like, go away, we're talking. And why they chose to hash this all out in this very public, fancy restaurant sort of is strange to begin with.
It's a private matter. And they keep getting up from the table anyway.
Yeah,
no one stays at the table.
So that was very odd. And then they're telling things through flashback. But the thing that's important to note is there's two other things with this film. It's a family drama because these the Richard Gere and the Steve Coogan characters, they're brothers. And so the boys that are in trouble are cousins. And so it's all about how the dynamics play out in this family unit. And the brothers have been somewhat estranged for years. There's a component of mental illness that they're trying to portray in this film. And so it tries to do a lot. And I think by trying to do so much, it dilutes whatever the main message was supposed to be.
All right, so we both agree that the dinner is a dud. Our next film is a documentary. It's by an Oscar winner. She won, Miss Laura Poitras won for Citizen Four, a subject that just makes my blood boil. And so I did not go see Risk about Mr. Julian Assange, who has already had multiple feature-length documentaries composed about him. So is Risk worth the effort, Hannah?
It's interesting to see because... Did you see Citizen Four?
Oh, yeah, I saw the whole thing.
So what's interesting that you discover in this documentary about Julian Assange is Laura Poitras started filming in, like, 2010. And the Edward Snowden story sort of serendipitously happened while she was filming this Julian Assange story. And so she had to sort of play the, you know, follow two tracks during the years that she was filming, and she ended up, Citizen Four is the much stronger story, and that's probably why she did it first, is it had so much more drama, so much more tension, the stakes were so much higher. With Julian Assange, the problem is you just don't like him. He's not a very sympathetic guy. I think Edward Snowden came off as more sympathetic in Citizen Four than Julian Assange does in Risk, but that's also because overshadowing everything relating to WikiLeaks and his role in the release of thousands of documents of classified information from the government are these sexual abuse allegations against him. And
does she bring it up?
Oh yeah. So of course that's actually a huge part of this film. So this film is really a character study of Julian Assange and the hypocrisy of him, that here he, you know, claims to be all about principle and the importance of taking risks on the basis of principle. And yet he's very dismissive of the charges against him and dismissive of the women who are accusing him of rape. And so the access that Laura Poitras has is phenomenal. The fact that she is interviewing him constantly in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's been holed up since 2012. And so she was able to see firsthand as things were unfolding with the Brad Manning story, now Chelsea Manning. And so that sort of that plays a role in it. So there's this intersection of the Manning court-martial, the Edward Snowden NSA whistleblower leaks, and what was going on with Julian Assange with WikiLeaks and with law enforcement being after him for a whole bunch of things. So the fact that she had that access is phenomenal, and that's what makes it interesting to watch. Is you just see in real time some of these side stories unfolding. But Citizen Four is a much stronger film.
There already was an outstanding documentary made about Assange and WikiLeaks. It came out in 2013 or 14. It was one of my top 10 films that year. It's called We Steal Secrets, The Story of WikiLeaks. And it was majorly centered around Chelsea Manning, a little bit of Assange. General Michael Hayden had a big part in it. I just loved it. I think it was an Alex Gibney, Mr. Zero Days himself. So the world, I feel, is Assanged out. Could there be anything new?
It's new because it's all Assange. You are seeing him and his inner circle at work. And so you get a little bit of his confidant slash girlfriend, I guess. She's sort of, they never acknowledge whether there is a relationship there, but it's sort of implied. She was fascinating. Her name was Sarah something or other that I keep forgetting. Sarah Harrison, I think. And she's the one who essentially went to Hong Kong and helped Snowden.
I remember her. She was in Citizen Four.
She was in Citizen Four. And so she helped Snowden get from Hong Kong to Moscow and spent quite a few months there with him getting settled. And her story is fascinating because you're just like, why is she with Assange and defending him? And she's this idealist. And so maybe someday, Laura Poitras is working on a documentary on her as well. I wouldn't be surprised.
Did Laura Poitras ever ask Assange, why are you working for the Russians? And why did you want to get Donald Trump elected?
Well, and she does add, you can tell that they were editing and re-editing this latest cut of the film right up until probably a few weeks ago, because there is stuff with Donald Trump. This was certainly I went to a screening with a bunch of Washingtonians, and there was a Q&A with Laura Poitras. And so she said that this was not the film she set out to make. It turned into more of a tragedy because of things like the election of Trump. And so this movie even opens with this long shot of the Mexican border and talking about how it's like 1,900 miles long. And then, boom, you see this text pop up that's just, good luck with that wall. And everybody applauded in this very liberal audience. And then at the end, there's a bit of a tie-in with the Russian elections and with the congressional testimony and things like that. And the open-ended questions as to where that investigation will go. And so that's the thing with this film, is it feels like yet another piece in a puzzle of a story that has not reached its conclusion yet.
Oh, I'm glad I skipped it. I'm tired of that man. On a completely different note, our next film is animated. And it's experimental, I think you could call it. It's called My Entire High School Sinking into the Sea. It's by a man named Dash Shaw. He's a comic book artist. This is his first feature film. But he got some major star talent to voice characters in this psychedelic, cliquish high school setting. And it's an experimental film. It's a throwaway film. It's not,
it's weird.
Our main character is—he's a sophomore now. He's so proud. I'm a sophomore now, and he works for the daily newspaper that there's not a lot of to write about in Tides High School. His name also goes by his name of Dash, so the guy's name after the director, and it's voiced by Jason Schwartzman, Mr. Max Fisher from Rushmore himself, and it might as well be Max Fisher. It sounds like Max Fisher. He talks the same. He acts the same. He's kind of a pariah in his high school. It's Max Fisher from Rushmore. He wrote the same character. Tides High is built on a fault line. There's an earthquake. The high school literally falls into the sea. There's sharks. People are dying. People are drowning. People are getting electrocuted.
It's a comedy.
I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. It's right there in the middle. Glad I saw it. Because, you know, it's short. There's a lot worse things out there, like the dinner. I enjoyed seeing... I'm happy I saw someone try something new, Hannah.
I would not say I liked it more than the dinner. The only reason I made it through...
Did you finish it?
I finished it because it was 77 minutes long. And knowing that it was only 77 minutes long, I stuck by it because I was just curious. And it's supposed to be some sort of satire, disaster movie, high school comedy. I think I read IndieWire, somebody called it like a... John Hughes for the Adult Swim crowd.
That's funny. That's really good.
And I was like, yeah, that probably is because I'm not an Adult Swim person. Like, I just don't watch any of those Adult Swim cartoon shows for adults. And so I just didn't get it. And if I think for those who are Adult Swim viewers, this is probably right up their alley. But for everyone else, it's very strange. It's just a strange
movie. It is strange, but it's not strange awful. Susan Sarandon is Lunch Lady Lorraine, and she's got a prominent role. Lena Dunham shows up as kind of the popular mean girl. Maya Rudolph is also part of the journalist staff, so they really got some talent going on here. And it's funny how they, after their... You know, the high school's falling apart, and they form into cliques. So their goal is like, we need to get up to the senior floor, and then we need to graduate onto the roof. And the senior floor is commanded by this, you know, football star. It's actually John Cameron Mitchell, Mr. Hedwig and the Angry Inch himself. The animation, it's not professional. It's kind of really comic bookish. Really, these really thick outlines, these drawn outlines. It gets psychedelic every yes. now and then. Like, there's some LSD almost reference. Like, it just looks like that kaleidoscopic motif.
I felt like I was watching Scooby-Doo off the rails, you know?
It's innovative. You know what? No one else is doing it. Why doesn't, you know, might
no
as well.
One else is doing it because nobody really cares to see it.
It's better than some throwaway like Rock Dog.
I don't know. I still, it just didn't appeal to me. It had no major entertainment value for me, and it was just a little too bizarre. Unlike, you know, you think about an adult comedy animation like a Sausage Party, and this one
a lot cruder. That was a lot cruder,
but a lot more. The line, it was just more clever.
Well, the script was better. This script yes. could have been so much better. It's sophomoric. Pardon the pun.
Oh, you think so? I have my favorite line here. His words sunk in like urine on a pair of tidy whiteys.
You're not going to set that up, are you? No. He said that on purpose.
I know.
He said, I hate turgid prose. No, he said, I love turgid prose. And then he goes on to describe that. And he's like, oh. That's turgid prose.
Yeah.
So I said it on purpose.
No, I know they're saying it on purpose, but it's just that sort of that's just to give you a sense of the type of dialogue. And I know it's all tongue in cheek and it is satire. And so when one of the characters, I think the one, Maya Rudolph's character, Verdi, who is starting, there's this budding relationship between her and Dash's friend, Asif, she says something to him. He asks her. He's wondering why she's interested in him at all. And he says, you think I'm boring or my writing's probably boring. And she's like, no, you're not boring. It's, truthful or something like that. And there's beauty in truth. I mean, it was just a little over the top.
Well, this is just a great palate cleanser I needed between garbage like the dinner and something we're going to talk about much later.
It wasn't a palate cleanser for me.
But our next film, I think, is the best documentary I saw this week. I learned a lot about a subject I never think about, which is urban city planning. Citizen Jane, Battle for the City, Jane Jacobs versus Robert Moses, David versus Goliath. And in a movie about Jane Jacobs, it's a lot about Robert Moses, which is off-putting, Hannah.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a girl power documentary. It's fascinating to learn about this woman's story. I certainly didn't know about it. I think it's a very traditional documentary in the way it's presented. It's a lot of, you know, talking heads, but it does a good job of just showing how this one person can really make a huge difference. And she rallied other women to battle this guy, to preserve New York and New York neighborhoods as much as possible when this guy basically had carte blanche to raise entire neighborhoods and put up crisscrossing highways. And so it was, she was trying to make the point that urban planners needed to really think about the X factor, the intangibles of what makes a city vibrant, and it's the people. And so you can't just plan around the people and figure that that the people will make the community work once we build it. You have to build the community around the people.
Yeah, I never thought about that. She writes this seminal, notorious 1961 book called The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And she celebrates people making the city. Sidewalk culture is what she calls it. People mm-hmm. out in the streets. That means there's not a lot of crime because your children are playing in the streets, so your parents are watching. But if you build these major expressways and you tear down the neighborhoods and you put up these projects, which back then was not a dirty word yet, they made the projects, then nobody's out in the streets anymore. That's where crime comes in. And so they show an example of the Bronx. Robert Moses puts the major expressway through the Bronx and he cuts it into North and South Bronx, and the Bronx just fell apart. It became the borough you just did not go to. And he wanted to do it again. He wanted to do it into Manhattan and pretty much take away what we now call Soho. Mm-hmm. Gone. She mobilizes. We would call it grassroots now. Signatures. There's some outstanding stock footage that and video interviews that director Matt Tiernauer digs up. And he's got a great score to go along with it. I mean, the score felt like, ooh, it's pushing me forward. I'm paying attention. That's by a woman named Jane Antonina Cornish. What a great score. Great video footage. Draggy a little bit.
Yeah.
but an interesting subject.
It is an interesting subject, and I think it's timely in light of the Women's March on Washington, because really she's rallying women and mothers, and it's almost like Robert Moses didn't know what hit him when suddenly the power of all these women, you know, kind of came together to stop him in his tracks. And Jane Jacobs was sort of one of the original pioneers of understanding a good photo op and knowing the kind of image you needed to project and getting the picture of the mother with her baby in a baby carriage standing there fighting for her community. And so to me, it kind of was very reflective of the current state of women trying to come together on Washington and really making a statement and showing how the power of a united group of people can really make a difference. And so, I mean, it's not the type of movie you necessarily need to run out and see on the big screen, but I think it's sort of a love letter to New York. So New Yorkers who live in these different communities might get something out of it, and it should be required viewing for any students of urban planning.
Architecture students should be all over this. The main talking heads are architecture critics and actual architects, and it goes a long way in saying that Robert Moses underestimated Jane Jacobs. I think he called her once just a mother. You know, what's she going to do to me? And there was a James Baldwin tie-in by one of my top 10 from last year, my favorite documentary, I Am Not Your Negro. They call it the same interview. He's talking about Robert Moses' proposal of urban removal into the projects. And he's like, urban removal is code for Negro removal. That's what you're doing. And I was like, oh, I've seen that interview. I saw it just last year. And so I love that tie-in. The last half hour of it's all about the car. The introduction of what cars do in the city, cars the wave of the future, and we must make way for cars and build all these roads, and that's actually city destroying. You don't need these amazing expressways to move cars around. And they'll get through. Your cities are just far more important, especially now that there's, you know, what is it, every 2 months, the population of Los Angeles, I can't think about that statistic right now, but the amount of urbanization going on in the world right now that they point out is mind-blowing. No one lives on the farm anymore. They live in the city, and Jane Jacobs knew what to do with them.
Yeah, no, it's a good tribute to Jane Jacobs, and I think that definitely urban planning, city planning, women's studies, sustainability issues, anyone interested in those topics should find this one.
Unlike our next film, which is not only the worst film of the week, it's the worst film of the year so far. Buster's Mall Heart. And this is a title that should, you know, discourage any window shopping at all. Mall being the Spanish word for bad. And so he's kind of a Spanish speaker in this film, which is why she plays with the title like that. Director Sarah Adina Smith, writer-director Sarah Adina Smith, got Rami Malek, Mr. Robot himself. Very recognizable man to play a man who gets no sleep. He works the night shift as a concierge at this out-of-the-way kind of mountain resort hotel. And he doesn't have a lot to do. He vacuums the floor that's already been vacuumed. He paces the hallways, and there's no one to talk to. He's got a family at home, a wife, and a young toddler that, you know, want to talk and play with him when he's off work. And he just never gets any sleep. And he looks it. His eyes look awful. And, you know, he's got a very recognizable face. And he can pull it off very well. And then jump ahead, I don't know how long, and he's a mountain man, and he's got the longest beard you've ever seen, and he's roaming the mountain, and he's breaking into vacation homes just to, you know, have somewhere to be, stay warm, and he leaves them pretty much as he doesn't destroy them. He leaves them basically as he finds them, except every now and then he defecates in some pots and leaves them there.
Ooh.
And then cut to him in a boat, and he's looks like he's been at sea for like a year, and he's baking to death under the sun in this lifeboat with no food and no water. I don't know how it all fits together. I don't. It's so opaque. It's so vague. I'm sure there's meaning under there, but I got so frustrated watching this movie. She doesn't give me any answers, and people are defending this movie. It's like, oh, it's so deep. No,
who's
it's not.
Who's defending it?
The standard. Just
I hadn't heard anything about it. Like, even the name, I kept forgetting what that other movie was that you had seen. And so when I was just simply running out of time with the number of movies we'd been seeing this week, not only did that one just in its synopsis and its title absolutely make me not want to see it. Once you did see it, And I read your review, and I think you gave it, what, like a half star? Mm. I was like, yeah, I'm not going to go out of my way to pack that one into this really crowded week of movies.
Well, I didn't know when it was. And then someone shows up and starts warning Buster about Y2K, about how Y2K is going to end humanity and the universe is going to turn in on itself. And that kind of snaps a screw loose in Buster, and he does something bad. He does something real bad, which is how he ends up as a mountain man, just kind of a loner. I don't know what the movie's about. Is it about mental illness? Because Buster, his name was Jonas, now it's Buster. He's mentally ill. He's got a problem. So is it about mental illness? Or is it about society's rules, trying to pin down the free man? Because he's kind of libertarian. He's like, I want to buy a piece of land and just live off it, self-sufficient style. And society's rules are, you know, we have these instincts as human beings to wander, as we did for millions of years. We just wandered, and now you're stuck behind a desk. Is it about that? I don't know what it's about. And it's so, just give me an answer, anything. And she refuses to do it.
Well, I have a fun little tie-in for you, because the creator of Mr. Robot was actually the executive producer of the Risk documentary with Laura Poitras.
It's pretty thin, Hannah.
Hey, I'm just connecting the dots for you, because, you know, since I know you're never going to go see Risk.
No.
I'm never going to see Buster. And nobody's ever going to see this next one, probably. Yeah, although maybe they should, or certainly students of history and, I don't know.
I want to end on a more positive note.
Yeah.
Encore Awakens, A Portrait of Cambodia, makes you think. It's by a man named Robert H. Lieberman. He did a documentary in 2012 called "They Call It Myanmar: Lifting the Curtain." So he's got an MO. He's sticking in Southeast Asia, and he wants you to teach about these countries. And Cambodia has had it rough. He starts where you think it would start: late 70s, Khmer Rouge. Millions of people are getting slaughtered. Goes way back in time to tell you about the Angkor Empire, Vietnam, kind of what happened, why did it cause the Khmer Rouge, all the way to today. And he gets a very interesting interview with a very powerful man that you usually don't see. Yeah. I got a kick out of Encore Awakens. It's a very small film.
It is.
But it really made me think about certain things. What did you think?
It's interesting. It's very much like a film, though, that you would watch in college. Like, we're in a high school history class.
He pulled all his talking heads from the same school,
by the way.
It is.
They're all like Cornell,
I believe.
Yeah,
they're all from Cornell.
Well, so it really is designed. It felt like one of those student history projects that's fascinating, but limited in its reach beyond, I think, the small screen. Like, I can't imagine many folks looking for it in like an art house theater to see it. Although it's fascinating. It is another one of those ones that, you know, you pull back the curtain. I think the interviews with even the prime minister, who makes these claims that it's like, you know, you think that I'm complicit in the killing of citizens,
which,
but
he
that's
is.
You know, but would you say that Obama was complicit when a New York City police officer killed a citizen? So he draws like those lines, and the poor interviewer's kind of like, not really the same thing. And so it's meant to be a cautionary tale, and so I think it is very important for that reason. It's amazing to see and hear how the Cambodian children of today don't necessarily really understand or know about all that went on really in the 1970s. Their parents and their grandparents have sometimes been very reluctant to talk about about the genocide that happened there. And what the director's trying to do in putting this film out there is really going, hey, it's very important to know what happened, how it happened, and why it happened, so that it doesn't happen again. And so you can't fault a film for that. I mean, that's a great premise. It's a wonderful thing to try and do. This guy had family connections to the Holocaust. It was very important to him personally to try and say, you know, when you see these things happening, when you see these parallels, you really need to take action and not be complacent and think that everything will just fix itself.
There have been documentaries and films about the Khmer Rouge before. We really don't learn that much new about that era of history. So That's why the second half of this film is a bit more intriguing. It's about contemporary Cambodia. As you mentioned, the children, the new generation on social media, and their parents kind of mock them. You don't know how to cultivate and bushel wheat? Well, if the Khmer Rouge come back, you're going to die. And they actually kind of, they don't talk about it a lot, but they think the Khmer Rouge could come back. It's not out of the realm of possibility for them. And the younger generation is like, no, no, that could never happen. And he gets an interview with Prime Minister Hun Sen. This is a bad guy. Like, a lot of this movie is about the corruption in Cambodia and how they have a lot of problems. And there's social protests in the street, people getting shot by police. And President Hun Sen, or Prime Minister Hun Sen, he's been in power since like 85. He's a bad dude. But he says, I'm democratically elected. Don't blame me. Blame the Constitution. It's fascinating that he got that interview. It makes this a very strong documentary.
It is a strong documentary, and I was a little flip at the beginning, mostly because I think I was just suffering somewhat from genocide fatigue, because as I mentioned earlier to you when we were talking about what we were going to talk about tonight, I said, you know, nothing says cinematic fun like another war documentary that exposes U.S. complicity in a modern genocide. And that's because just last week we had seen Finding Oscar, a documentary about Guatemala's dirty war and the genocide that occurred there. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, you know, this is just depressing to realize just over really the past 45, 55 years, how much tragedy and complicit activities. I mean, I'm sure, you know, not intentional, but terrible nonetheless, with the U.S. not necessarily recognizing what was happening on the ground with citizens of other countries and intervening as necessary. And so I did find it very interesting. In this film, they even have a little snippet of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, from Lieberman tied it into contemporary. Yeah, they had Bernie Sanders in the debate.
Yeah, so they had Bernie Sanders in the debate basically dissing Henry Kissinger and saying that Henry Kissinger was complicit, the administration back in the 70s in Cambodia, in the rise of the Khmer Rouge. And so that was interesting, just as with last week's Finding Oscar film, you kind of learned about how the Reagan administration kind of turned a blind eye and embraced the president of Guatemala when he was killing a bunch of people. So it just, they're all, you take them all together and there's a huge cautionary tale to be told here.
Yeah, it's got a PBS feel to it. Finding Oscar was a little bit more cinematic. This mm-hmm. is a bit more history lesson-ish. I could see it on PBS.
Yeah.
Lieberman gets a little cute when he's talking about Vietnam and the secret bombing of Cambodia by B-52s. It's kind of like papier-mâché B-52s, but they're shadow. Like shadow B-52s dropping these really large air-to-ground munitions that are also shadowed. And it's like puppetry. Yeah. It's like, all right, I see what you're doing, but yeah, I don't see the use there. But yeah, I guess you're trying to keep my attention. That's all well.
Well, and that's the difference when you have a documentary that's basically put together by a bunch of educators versus a documentary that has the power of Steven Spielberg behind it.
All right, there's a difference in funding.
There is.
All right, quick recap. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, by far the greatest film this week and the second best Marvel film of all time.
Certainly the best film of the week. I'll just leave it at that.
The Dinner. Garbage.
It's not that appetizing, but it's better than at least two of the other ones on our list this week.
Risk.
Risk is good if you saw Citizen Four and liked it and are interested in that whole Julian Assange WikiLeaks thing and want to see more of a another piece of this puzzle. It's not nearly as good as Citizen Four, but it's okay.
Sounds like it's beating a dead horse. My entire high school, Sinking into the Sea, it's quirky, it's for the anime lovers, it's for the out-of-the-box thinkers, and it's better than The Dinner.
I didn't get it. I like The Dinner better, sorry.
Citizen Jane, Battle for the City is the best documentary this week. Urban planning is actually very important.
Yeah, I think Citizen Jane, Battle Cry for the City is an interesting tale that that will have some appeal. I don't think you need to see it in a big theater, but it certainly is a good one to seek out when it's on a rental.
Buster's Mallheart is the worst film of the year so far. Like, it's worse than Triple X, The Return of Triple X.
I'm just kind of bummed that, you know, I'm going to have a really difficult time writing up my worst films of the year for this year because I've been sort of skipping them appropriately.
Encore Awakens, Portrait of Cambodia. An important film, an intriguing film, especially the second half. Yeah, thumbs up.
Yeah, definitely good, maybe for the high schoolers and the college students, especially anybody who is studying modern history.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to The Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.